IATSE 891 presents Apple Box Talks, the podcast where we get to talk to the very best artists, technicians, and interest holders that make up the BC entertainment industry. From prep to post and everything in between, we create worlds on screens of all sizes.
Welcome to Apple Box Talks. I'm Hillary.
And I'm Crystal. And today we're getting to know more about the department that serves as the logistical and creative link between physical production and post-production, the artists and technicians of the visual effects department.
With credits to their name, such as Star Trek Beyond, The BFG, The Flash, and Percy Jackson and the Olympians, we're joined on the Apple Box today by member and chair of the visual effects department, Sam Kim. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for coming in. So talk to us about your first introduction to the motion picture and television industry here in BC.
Well, I actually came to school here to attend film production at Vancouver Film School. So that's kind of the reason that I came to Vancouver. It was a major movie hub, and it's something that I wanted to get into. So from that, it was a pretty much a short jump after attending school to jumping right on production. It turned out to be a great time because things were ramping up here. So here I am.
And did you come from another jurisdiction that just didn't have a vibrant film industry? Or
I'm originally from Edmonton. So, there's maybe just one or two that might be coming through town. So I specifically sought out Vancouver as a location where I can work in the film and television industry. So
actually, I'm also from Alberta, and that's exactly why I came here. So I wanted to clarify, because visual effects in our agreement is slightly different than what people think of as animation and visual effects companies, etc. Can you explain to us the difference between on-set visual effects and what you do under our agreement and visual effects houses and animation?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up, because that is a very important distinction. What we typically cover is the on-set technical side of visual effects. So generally, when you hear visual effects, they think of, oh, it's guys sitting at the computer, working on Blender or Maya, creating these 3D models and, all these magical effects that can happen from that. What we mainly focus on is the on-set side. So what we do as technicians is we try to capture everything that does happen on set, all the references, all the scanning, all the photography, all the plates, et cetera, et cetera. So we can marry what happens on real production to what happens in post. We'll try to make it as seamless as possible.
That's a super helpful bridge, because I learned about 12 new words in everything that you just said. So for the people in the back or me, can you give an example of what that would look like from a movie that maybe some of our superhero kind of movies or things that we know that we often think of in the bigger public of this has got a lot of visual effects in it. Like what does your role look like? Can you give a specific example for me?
It's kind of broad, the things that we do. So basically, an example would be, say, I worked on Star Trek, as you mentioned, so like shooting on the bridge of Star Trek. So we create the big main screen, the main viewer. We create things that are, not real in there. So what happens on set is they'll shoot either against a blue screen or a green screen, replace that section. So that is what we're going to replace. So what we do is we take all the camera information, so what lenses they used, what the camera moves were, the tilts, the heights, all that. We generally film that with witness cameras, which basically just witness what the camera is doing in relation to what happens in the scene. And so that way we can also we put up tracking markers on that blue screen or green screen, so we can see how it all moves in parallax, which is, the foreground moves different from the background, so we know exactly, what that distance and what happens with that image. And we marry that all together. We take a bunch of photography, we scan the sets. We try to give the artists everything that they need to make sure that what they put in there is going to match exactly what happens or what we actually shot on the day.
Can I ask a question that I've never actually known the answer to?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
There's someone on set that holds like a big silver ball on a stick. Can you tell me the mechanics of what that visual effects technician is doing on set?
Yes. So basically what we do is we, you know, call those sphere references or ball references. And what it does is it captures on set the actual lighting conditions of how the director of photography has actually lit the set. And we use that information to match what we do in our CG environment. So basically, when you create something in CG, it needs to be also lit the same way that we do in the principal plates of what we actually shoot practically. So that allows us to marry the two. It gives reference for the gray is usually a matte reference. The silver is, you know, a specular reference. So artists can match that. There's some software that can extract the lighting information from that, depending on what facilities use what program. That's all kind of customized. But yeah, it gives what we call a ground truth, which is, you know, the reality. This is the base of what actually happened there.
So the people in the VisFX houses are not just trying to figure out or guess as to what the lighting conditions were. They actually have the lighting conditions and can replicate them.
Exactly.
And CG, for those of you at home that may not know, computer generated.
Correct, yes.
So was it always going to be visual effects for you?
No, it wasn't. Originally, I entered the film industry, as many aspiring filmmakers do, to direct and create their own productions. So that is a program that I attended to at Vancouver Film School. And it gave a very basic base knowledge that you learn for, you know, doing, making your own movies as an independent filmmaker. So, you know, all the different departments. So for visual effects, I've actually kind of fell into it. I've did a bunch of other roles working in the film industry, starting as a PA. I'd done camera work for a bunch of independent shows. I did gripping, I did lighting, I've worked in the production office, and I had an opportunity to work in visual effects as a visual effects assistant on Final Destination 5 as my first visual effects gig. Mm-hmm. And that was a wonderful experience because I come from a very strong technical background. You know, I played around with cameras for a very large portion of my childhood and teen years. So very familiar with that. And so it was kind of a natural fit. It was very easy for me to get into that workflow, and it was exciting and new, and the technology was also evolving. So it's something that I really enjoyed learning from various people and the various different ways that people approach visual effects. So it's been a wonderful experience, and I stuck around with it.
And speaking of how technology's changed over time, how do you see your department having changed over the evolution of your time in membership? And talk to us a little bit about how you feel AI or how you see AI impacting visual effects in the way that you do them.
Well, in terms of how the department itself has changed over the time, the role that IATSE plays is it supports the members, visual effects members, once you join as a technician. Now, there's a bit of a loophole that currently resides within the contract in that productions can hire non-union members as well as members, and they're not necessarily beholden to hire members, even though the rest of the crew is under the 891 or the collective agreement. So it's kind of this weird spot where some shows are totally open and willing to hire members and others where they refuse to hire our specific department as union members. So in that, it's been a lot of struggle, and it's been very, very small incremental changes that have evolved in my experience so far over the years. So it is a bit of a challenge for sure to continue pushing for that. And for our membership, there's generally a higher turnover just because there isn't much protection for members and for the struggle that they have with productions hiring non-union people. And they have the full right to not if they don't want to. So it makes it, makes it very hard. But in terms of how AI is impacting the visual effects department, generally, like I said, we aren't as involved just because we handle the onset side. So that's very hands-on. That's something that we need, you know, humans on the ground for. We need people to actually, you know, take the reference photos, to get all the measurements, to do the things that we need to do the scans. It's not something that can be easily automated. So it hasn't affected us too much that way. But in terms of the greater visual effects industry, it is a major technical changeover that's happening. So it makes things interesting.
So like in a movie, like in 2018, one of the Avengers movies set the record for the most number of people credited in a movie, more than 2,000 of them being visual effects members.
Yes.
But a lot of people wouldn't think about that being an on-set position because so much of it's happening outside, like you're talking
Correct.
About. And those are the areas more where we're seeing that push because it changes how the workflows work for those workers and those pieces. How do you thread that needle in that gray area when so many of your union kin are adamantly opposed to any kind of AI usage?
It is difficult, but it's kind of such a ground-shifting technology that's happening that it's almost unavoidable. If you think of like the transition from film to digital, it's kind of on that scale where there's going to be massive workflow changes. The way that we do things is going to be changed quite a bit. It'll make things, you know, faster. It'll make things more efficient. Will it make things necessarily better? That is highly debatable. But, you know, we definitely want to do as much as we can to help the work, but we also want to push the boundaries of what is being created and how we do things in order to make things more efficient. Because the one thing that really drives the visual effects industry and movie making as a whole is, you know, cost savings. Where is that money going? How is it being utilized? How effective are we going to be? And it's really pushed down hard on visual effects facilities just because the margins are so small. What happens for visual effects on films is on the business side. The principal photography happens. We shoot the film, and then we figure out what the shots are going to be that need visual effects. And historically what happens is with those visual effects shots, we talk to different facilities. Sometimes they're involved earlier, sometimes they're involved later, but we ask them, okay, how much is this going to cost? Like, how do we make this achievable? And so it almost becomes a race to the bottom because you talk to various houses and they say, okay, we can do this for $4 million. We can do this for $2 million. We can do this for, you know, $7 million. And generally productions go with the lowest bidder. And what happens, like for facilities such as Rhythm and Hughes, is that they would rather take a loss and be promised future work to create those shots. And they did, you know, some beautiful, beautiful visual effects on a whole bunch of shows, but they couldn't afford it because their margins were so, so tight and even underbidding occasionally to make these projects happen. So that's kind of the system that the whole visual effects industry is built on, which is why we see such a high turnover in terms of ownership of the houses. You see these facilities getting sold and bought up by other, you know, media conglomerates. And it makes it really tough.
Yeah, and that speaks to the work of the organizing of the international, right? Because where a lot of those really vulnerable non-union workers are, and getting placed on projects like that or in those houses. And so I know the international has made some really good moves in that direction. And hopefully that can trickle down into impacting the work that is, by language of some of our agreement, not covering some of our visual effects people, because we work really hard to try to mitigate those problems, as you know, as the union. But once they're covered, right?
Exactly.
So it has been a very long and difficult, painful road. But even in the international, covering Avatar, getting that, because there was so much non-union work going on James Cameron's films, that was a big win for for VisFX in general as well. But I just want to roll back to the fact that, you know, visual effects can lead the way in AI and can actually be the human beings that are making and leveraging the tech and it, like, making it better. Our conundrum is where it's moving so fast, right? And
yes,
we don't want tech people out of jobs. We want them to be able to work with it, make it better, adapt. And so tell us how practically, like, is there a specific tool that you think of when you say we push to use this tech? Is there a specific task associated or?
Not really. A large portion of the visual effects work that happens in facilities is trying to make things more efficient, you know, doing things faster, better on a cheaper budget, right? So that's kind of the driving force of why we embrace a lot of these machine learning tools. And it's kind of like evolved from that aspect. So it's made in order to help artists churn out work faster and better. And, you know, it's
a bit of a meat grinder, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is. It is. Like I said, it's a global marketplace and it's very, very, very competitive. Mm-hmm. And that's just kind of how the industry has been doing things. And that's how everyone is used to doing things. So it makes things difficult to change. But that's kind of what we are looking forward to with what IATSE is trying to do, because as we all know, as union members and as people who work in this film industry, union work doesn't necessarily mean bad work, right? We negotiate what we do because we know what we're worth and we know that the value that we bring to all productions. So just because some houses become unionized doesn't necessarily mean that their value is, you know, worth less than what they're being paid for. That it can actually enhance what work does actually happen, because, you know, better working conditions, you make happier people, better workers, more efficient workers. And a good work environment will really produce good results, is something that I believe, and something that the International, I believe, is on board with. So we don't necessarily need to go to India to, you know, the cheaper work labor markets to create visual effects when we can do it in North America, possibly under union leadership, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it just speaks to how global a nature our industry is, right? And how when Trump was talking about taxing, you know, all of the entertainment companies that take their work offshore, like, well, how would you do that? Because if we have a portion filming here, you're doing the editorial in Los Angeles, your composer's in Germany, and then all your visual effects are in India, like, it doesn't work like that. That's why arts and culture have been historically exempt from tariffs, right? So it is a complicated puzzle and everything's getting more expensive. And so how do we then reel back in, like, this very cheap non-unionized labor? How do we circle them into the tent, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, if you look at history, when unions are able to raise the lowest bars, you know, everyone is able to, you know, rise with that. So by establishing, okay, this is, you know, if we unionize this place and it creates these fantastic works, we attract all the talent, we get all that, there's still a baseline that happens for quality, right? And what we try to do is we try to get everyone on board to raise that up.
When you raise the floor on something, everybody else gets stronger, whether they understand how or not. I mean, Hillary is also well into the labor movement, so can also add her piece to this as well. But it would be great if everyone all over the world was unionized and we were all starting from a baseline where we were, you know, and that was the level by which the people that are being hired offshore could be as protected and as well paid as we are, right?
Yes, exactly. That's the goal.
And it's always the tension of human nature in that mix, though, right? Because you have solidarity, you fight and you fight and you fight to establish that floor. And then there is a certain level of attrition of participation when it's like, well, we got ours because we're unionizing and practicing solidarity and collective bargaining in a highly capitalistic environment. So there's always that tension of how to continue building that momentum, how to continue expanding that base, where we have enough of us together to kind of bring that critical mass together where unionized work can impact a capitalist structure, either by the impact of a work stoppage, the impact of collective action in some other way, or having enough folks from outside the labor umbrella say, well, now we want that too, right?
Exactly.
Like we're always in that flux of how much we can get people to participate after they've quote-unquote got theirs out of the altruism of bringing more people in to benefit so that we're all rising up. And capitalism intentionally puts us in that tension, right? So I feel like your department understands that the most acutely out of just about everybody we talk to internally within the membership, because you live that every day based on the work that you're doing under contract on the floor, knowing that a lot of what you're doing is then leaving that space.
It's a battle for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one that we know well internally in the hall.
Let's circle back to some joy here.
I've just been sitting here waiting to talk about Star Trek more because we always know that that's where it's going to come back to the second anyone says Star Trek.
So maybe this question will lead us there. Talk to us about some of your absolute favorite projects or something you worked on that you walked away and went, damn, I'm proud of that. Like, that's a real feather in my cap.
And if you didn't like working on Star Trek, please don't tell me because it will break my heart.
No, Star Trek was definitely one of the top movies that I've had the opportunity and the pleasure to work on. It was a fantastic experience, and not just because of the work that we were doing, but just the crews, right? That was part of any fantastic show. I've, you know, really been lucky in working with a bunch of fantastic crews, and it really helps elevate the level of work and the production value that comes out of it, because you really take the pride to make all those little details matter. Some of the shows that I also enjoyed was something like, you know, Lost in Space was another big one that was, you know, lots of fun, fantastic crew, and I think one of the major primary drivers for what makes these shows or these movies so good is that they take the time to do things the right way. I know there's no specific right way, but it makes such a huge difference when things are planned ahead and they afford you the time and the resources to do things, you know, well. So you get everything that you need on the days or even after the days to give to our post-production facilities to say, hey, this is what we did. You know, we give them mountains of information, tons of data, and they can do their magic with that instead of giving them scraps and being like, hey, can you make something fantastic out of this?
Now, those two shows specifically that you mentioned took place before the global production slowdown, before the strikes, and, you know, the situation we find ourselves in where companies are merging and everything is just squeezed to the max. Can you tell us, are you experiencing those budgets smaller, those crews smaller, those timelines tighter?
Oh, yeah, for sure, definitely. Now, the funny thing is that it hasn't really changed that much.
Okay.
Despite...
Well, the work would be the same.
Yeah, the work is the same.
It's just the timeline and the budgets, right?
Exactly. And those are still pretty squeezed, right? I guess the main difference is that there are less productions willing to take that time and utilize that budget in a manner that, you know, allows the quality of work to be where it needs to be to really shine. I mean, there's productions that, you know, happened before the squeeze, before the strikes, before the pandemic, that were super tight on budget and, you know, pinching pennies to make everything work the way that they want. And sometimes it's great to do that because you really want to push the boundaries. You don't want to work on something that's, you know, you don't want something that's just okay, mm-hmm. you know, that meets the minimum criteria to make it palatable. mm-hmm. So it's nice, and I get why people really are ambitious, and the writers and the directors and the actors, and trying to make things, you know, these wonderful things. And sometimes you pull off miracles. Sometimes you pull off some amazing shows or amazing effects that, you know, really do the show justice or do the story justice. But yeah, I don't think it's changed too much from that, other than there's probably less quantity of work that is happening. So
you're like the human personification on set of We'll Fix It in Post. Like, I can just imagine there's got to be some moment where everyone's kind of like, oh no, hang on. And then they're all going to look at you.
Yeah.
Now what?
Absolutely. And that does happen. And sometimes we have to say, no, we can't do that. And it's interesting to see how the industry has evolved that way, where visual effects generally has become so relied upon now to, you know, fix those little things or to, you know, make this more visually spectacular, instead of, you know, planning things well and deciding how we can make it better editorially.
You know, you use the word magic. You know, we magically make things happen. And that's the human element. You know, that is such a common thread throughout our membership and, you know, the folks that are behind the scenes working. Like, it's not magic. It is highly skilled tacticians who go at this art form from every single angle. And no matter what, we deliver. And that's part of why we were, for so long, number three in production in the world. You know, and we're still high up there. It's just this constriction is really taking its toll on the global market. You know, we know things are going to the UK because of their tax incentive, et cetera. But really, the first thing we say in our marketing trips globally is we have the talented crew to make your show happen, and the infrastructure and all of the other supports around. But it's really all about the talent.
Yeah, for sure. It's essential. And yeah, we definitely do have a lot of talented members here in Vancouver.
We've said lots of times on this podcast, and we've interviewed members, it's also kind of unfair because for some of your departments, we spoke with Corey Roberts not that long ago, when you all are at your top excellent, it's when it goes the most unnoticed, because you don't want to be pulled out of the moment to realize, oh, that's visual effects, or oh, that's makeup, or whatever. Has it ruined kind of how you watch movies now?
In some ways, yes, for sure. And yeah, it's absolutely true that the best work is the invisible work, the stuff that, you know, that helps enhance the story or tell the story without pulling viewers out of it. So yeah, it's completely true. I definitely notice it when I watch movies as well, or television shows, is that when you don't notice that stuff and you reflect back on it later and you're like, oh, wow, that was absolutely, you know, that totally got me. And that's fantastic work. Whereas, you know, we like to pick apart some other things, or it's like, ooh, that couldn't have been, yeah, they could have done that better, or that, what was that?
Continuity is one of those things, sorry, that I noticed. I would say it's probably ruined the way my husband watched the shows, because I'm constantly talking.
That's exactly what I was about to say. My partner is in the construction department and has had for years the problem of saying, oh, that's a set. Oh, that's a set. And so now my 11-year-old will watch movies and say, well, that's a set. Drives me nuts.
So, Sam, picture yourself like 5 years from now, or just like in an ideal situation, where do you see yourself, and what would be your sort of dream project to work on?
Oh, that is a tough question.
One of your own, I bet.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. I would love that. But yeah, there's so many good stories out there, and I'd love to be involved creatively in helping tell those stories and enhancing those. Obviously, the most ideal situation is to have fantastic people to work with, right? That always makes the most memorable experiences, and sometimes the hardest shows are the ones that we look fondly upon, because we all work together to make this amazing product, and we're all part of that. So
it's my favorite part of this podcast, interviewing all these talented members.
Oh.
Just so you know.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Before we go, could you give advice to new people coming into your department?
It would have to be very specific advice. It's tough because what I'm familiar with and my background is the onset side, when so much of the work happens in facilities and in houses. So depending on what you want to do in visual effects, it's a lot of, you know, engaging with other people, with other, you know, visual effects artists, with other visual effects technicians, to really work with them, to be persistent in what you do and to excel at what you're after. In terms of trying to enter in the film side of this, for the onset side of things, I would recommend just getting your foot in the door, working as a PA or as an assistant. Generally, our crews are quite small, so you have to be persistent and, you know, available, talking to people, going to, you know, social events with visual effects people, working on independent movies and things like that in order to get your foot in the door and to make contacts. Because a lot of it is, you know, reaching out, and sometimes people are just like, hey, do you know someone who's able and willing to help or is interested in helping out? And yeah.
I would assume, though, that like a lot of non-union wouldn't have or be able to afford a lot of visual effects, just like they don't usually have construction shops or et cetera. Could you tell us, so when you say PA, we think DGC normally, right? Because that's where the PAs come in. Is there a way for someone who is, let's say, you know, wanting to assist a visual effects person or technician, is there a way for them to work in that sort of entry-level position?
Absolutely. That is the entry-level job. That's how I started, as being a visual effects assistant, just assisting in however I could, running witness cams or, you know, doing runs or, yeah. And it's just being available and talking to people, to the visual effects people. You mentioned the DGC, working as a PA. That is a good opportunity as well, just because you get to talk to everyone on set and to kind of get familiar with what everyone does. And if being an on-set visual effects technician is what you want to do, that is a great way to meet some of the on-set technicians and put your name out there and to talk to them and find out, you know, is this something that I really want to do? And if so, then, you know, now you have a contact.
That's so very true. It's like kind of the inspiration for the title of this podcast. And it's like when you're sitting around and a kind grip gives you an apple box to sit on and someone sits beside you and you have those conversations. It's so important, that networking, no matter what level you're at. Thank you for that.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
Apple Box Talks is an IATSE 891 production and is recorded on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples. The podcast is hosted by Business Representative Crystal Bronworth and Assistant Business Representative Hilary Bergshaw, and produced by Quentin Benetti. For more episodes, check out ourwork.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Apple Box.